I don't have any things to show, but I'd make up for it by making a comment on one of the images that William showed, the willow pattern Spode Pottery's plate. The Chinese now own it. They own the Spode Pottery. So all the recent productions of that plate are Chinese. Makes the modern world very complicated, doesn't it? This is, some people have used words like auto-orientalism. The Chinese are now producing chinoiserie for money. Well, in the first part of this double presentation, I want to outline the social conditions that underpin the development of operetta as a cosmopolitan genre in the early 20th century. The two genres people fix on it, operetta and jazz, and of course these are the two genres that Adorno recognizes as the new culture industry. In this period, there were a number of composers who had grown up with the experience of being able to make different kinds of cultural choices, and whose family lineage or place of birth gave them no direct or clear-cut cultural identifications. Instead, they had the experience of being able to move flexibly among cultural options. Take Franz Lehár, for example. His birthplace was in Komárom, Hungary, a city in two halves divided by the Danube. He was born in the northern half, so from 1920, he's Slovakian. Something that Imre Kalman never failed to remind him of, or Alfred Grunewald, or Julius Brammer. He was always the Slovak in Vienna. His mother was Hungarian, however, but of German descent. His father was Austrian. The diacritic mark, the mark over the A, that was Franz Lehár himself. His father didn't have that on the name. Lehár put it there so that it wouldn't be Lehár in Hungarian. He wanted to indicate the German R, the long R sound. And again, this is an example of how we also perform our own identifications. He's making that Hungarian. It's an interesting little thing to do. To further complicate Lehár's cultural environment, he studied at the Prague Conservatory. He got his first job in Vienna as a bandmaster. So there does not seem much point in trying to attach a national label to Lehár. It's cosmopolitan, the term that suits him best. It would appear to be confirmed by his own activities and the many varied geographic locations of his operettas, which are actually set in over a dozen different countries. Vodileche Zsint is Lehár's only opera set entirely in Hungary, and the only one of his operettas to be premiered in Budapest. It was given as Opak Chirta at the Királyi Színház, approximately, in 1918, and produced only a month later at the Theater an der Wien in Vienna. For those wondering about the location of Zigeuner Lieber, I should explain that most of it is actually in Romania, although there's a bit in Kurush Haga, which might hint I put it Kurush A, however you pronounce that in Hungary, wherever it is. And now, given the theme of the conference, I will add some brief remarks on how cosmopolitanism affected the way Silver Age operetta positioned themselves, the composers, towards exoticism and orientalism. It would be naive to deny that an operetta such as Leopold's Die Rose von Stahl indulges to some extent in cultural othering, but it differs in significant respects from exoticism and orientalism in representation of the cultural other. And this is where reception needs to be examined in combination with the subject positioning of operetta. By this I mean that those involved in the production of operetta made a variety of assumptions about the audience to whom they were catering. To satisfy the kind of aesthetic cosmopolitanism already evident in the appetite for adaptations of German operetta shown by audiences all around Europe and further afield, cultural traditions needed to be explained and shared and not become barriers that separate. And thus we find something closer to what the art critic Nicolas Bourriaud calls a translation of singularities rather than cultural misrepresentation. In contrast, exotic and orientalist representation techniques served a function of emphasizing difference or strangeness. They worked to produce recognition of the self as different to the other, and not to stimulate recognition of the self in the other, that is, sameness. If we reach back to the Mikado, we find perhaps the most pronounced example of an Eastern operetta in which the English audience recognized itself, even if the eponymous character enters to a Japanese tune. To recognize the self in the other is a key characteristic of the cosmopolitan disposition. Many of the individuals who enjoyed multiple cultural attachments were Jewish artists. Karl Mann, for example, composed operettas to both Hungarian and German texts. A diaspora may make great efforts to retain cultural traditions, but may also assimilate other cultural knowledge and practices, and a diasporic cosmopolitanism forms a significant dimension of the art world of operetta. Operetta involved a considerable number of Jews working in all aspects of its production. An ability to move easily between different cultural options sometimes meant that Jewish artists found themselves described negatively as rootless cosmopolitans, as a favorite jibe. You know, I don't know who was the first person to think that roots are a good thing, but I'd like to stand them in a flower pot for about 6 hours. However, there was a keen desire and thus a market for the cosmopolitan in the metropolis. The cosmopolitan sensibility may include a sense of an identity that relates to place, but is not constrained by place. The urban Viennese waltz, for example, was already international by the mid-19th century, whereas the rustic Ländler carried strong Austrian associations. A Jewish artist may form multiple attachments, for instance, to other countries where friends and relations perhaps once lived, to friends and relations who are not Jewish, and to a country of birth. The Jewish creative artist often embodied a cosmopolitan disposition while also identifying as, say, Russian Jew or German Jew. To think that German Jews did not think themselves German, for example, was to fall prey to Third Reich propaganda. The term embedded cosmopolitanism has been used to describe those who have a strong attachment to a community but readily interact with others and demonstrate cultural openness. Regrettably, in the 1930s came a period of social upheaval and migration in which displaced persons, many though not all of them Jewish, began to affect the course of European culture. Two of the preeminent stars of operetta were Fritzi Massary, Jewish by heritage, Protestant by religion, Richard Tauber, Jewish but Roman Catholic by religion, derided by the Nazis as the languishing tenor who demanded 2,600 marks a night. From 1934 on, a once thriving operetta culture was quickly disintegrating, even if it did continue to survive in the absence of many of its leading figures and under watchful Nazi eyes. One of the cruelest ironies of these later years is that Leon Jessel, the Jewish composer of what I would regard as the ultra-German operetta Die Schwarzwaldmädel, was murdered by the Gestapo. One of the surprises is that Oscar Strauss was helped to escape by a German officer on a Swiss train who happened to be a big fan of Ein Walzertraum. To return to Franz Lehár, Hitler's favorite composer. He was a Roman Catholic but married to Sophia Paschkis, who was Jewish. She converted to Catholicism, but that meant little to Nazi fanatics. Thus, seeing what had happened to so many of his artistic collaborators, Lehár was left constantly worried about his wife's safety. Fritz Lerner-Weder, who was the librettist with whom Lehár had often worked on 5 different operettas, was arrested and sent to Dachau in April 1938, the month after the Austrian Anschluss. Lehar petitioned for his release. Documents are now being located. It was often wondered, did he do anything at all to try and help? But it was to no avail, and the records show now that his ex-librettist was beaten to death in Auschwitz III, Monowitz, on 4th of December 1942. The person who did it was actually tried in Frankfurt and not charged. He was released. Insufficient evidence. I want to end by asking if Nazi music policy did any lasting damage to the output of Jewish composers. And in some cases, I believe the answer is yes, for two reasons. First, it meant that previously highly esteemed work could fall into neglect, and given the theme of the present conference, I'll choose Carl Goldmark as an example. In a recent article on the composer, David Brodbeck, informs us that before the Anschluss, Goldmark's opera Die Königin von Saba had been performed 277 times in Vienna, but adds it's been rarely heard since. We must hope that the recent performance, I hope this went ahead at the Erkel Theatre in October and November, will re-establish it in the repertoire. The second way in which the Nazis damaged Jewish composers is in the embarrassment they caused for those performing or producing music that carried with it reminders of the hateful treatment that its creators had received. This was especially noticeable in the neglect of operettas by once popular Jewish artists. How could you enjoy this music when you were aware of what had happened to so many of its creators? And I think it's only now, under the leadership of the Australian Barry Kosky, that the Komische Oper in Berlin is finding a way of paying respect to these artists and revealing once more what wonderful life-affirming entertainment is to be found in a work such as Paul Abraham's Baal im Savoy. This is double paper, as you're aware, so it's based on research undertaken as part of a European Research Council project on German operetta reception. So I'm now making way for Dr. Belinda Johnson to offer additional evidence in support of the perspective I've presented, but her research is actually focused on the cultural transfer of operetta from Vienna and Berlin to Warsaw. Over to you.
Thank you. When we think of operetta reception in Europe, Warsaw is not the first city that comes to mind readily. We, of course, will think first of Vienna, Berlin, London, Paris, and of course Budapest. But Warsaw was a major operetta center in Poland, followed by Krakow and Lwów. There were also other cities in Poland where operetta was performed and very popular, like Wilno and Katowice and Bydgoszcz, for example. Just to demonstrate how valued and how interesting operetta was to Polish audiences, these are the 64 theatres in Warsaw, just in the city of Warsaw, that existed between 1859 and 1939. And this figure does not include theatres that were private or amateur. So these are all theatres where each theatre had operetta in their repertoire. So the popularity of this genre was immense. Between the two wars, the summer theatres, or summer operetta theatres, were also very, very popular in Poland. And this is one of the most famous summer theatres in Warsaw, called Teatr Letni, and that's what it looked like on the inside. And it was situated in the park, which is very close now to Teatr Wielki, the main opera house in Warsaw. Unfortunately, it was destroyed in the war. And the theatre also, of course, staged operettas. And summer theatres were very popular, and they were very well protected, or the performances were very well protected from the outside noise. If the performance was given, all the streets around the theatres were laid with hay so that the carriages and the horses' hooves wouldn't detract from the performance. There were hundreds of these theatres that all had French, German, and homegrown operetta in the repertoire. Before the World War I, operetta had absolutely no competition in Warsaw. It had publicity, it had the stars, excellent directors, dazzling stage sets, lighting designers, and so on. The works were chosen for their ability to enable designers and directors to put on a magnificent show. They also tried to make operetta stagings as truthful as possible, and so for that reason we have horses, donkeys, dogs, and even deer on stage. I think I had, this is Victoria Kawecka, one of a very, very famous operetta singers in Poland. She's on a donkey in one of the operettas here. The music was not always considered to be the most important thing when it came to staging operettas. The public were enchanted with colorful fantasies that were of similar nature to Parisian revues, and one of the critics put, were beautiful sets, lights, and beautiful women merged into an interesting kaleidoscope with humor and satire. Local issues were often explored only superficially, leaving the space and time for a more cosmopolitan engagement with modernity. While operetta is a cosmopolitan genre, I guess it lends itself very easily to traveling. You could change the text and the setting, maybe in the names and the title, to fit into the cultural and political scene of the designated country of performance. In Warsaw, not so many of these changes were always often necessary for Warsawian audiences. Of course, Warsaw had very good connections and links with Paris and Berlin and Vienna and Budapest, so the changes were not so necessary, not so frequent. What the directors tended to change, however, were the jokes, and many critics note that jokes and innuendos often got too saucy, too suggestive in the operettas that were performed in Warsaw. As I said, that there were theatres in Warsaw dedicated solely to performances of operetta, and the singers who worked there, who were engaged there, were unrivaled celebrities who were adored by the public and the critics. And one of the, this is the main operetta theatre in Warsaw, called Teatr Nowości. It rivaled with Vienna for the quality of its productions. Frustratingly, the theatre survived the war, but it was destroyed after the war because it was considered to be a remnant of bourgeoisie culture, which was undesirable. And I'm still trying to locate where some of the archives went from this theatre. It was built in 1901 and had the capacity for 1,300 seats. It was a really lucrative theatre. It was sold out performances. It had sold out performances. Between 1921 and 1932, it changed management several times, and it was, in addition to being called Nowości, it was also called Metropolitan Operetta Theatre, Messal Neverovska Theatre, and Orpheum. And in its repertoire were all the new works of European operetta. Many of them were given with enormous success. This is a photograph of the queue to the box office of Nowości to get the tickets from one of the performances. These are just some of the performers who were working in the theatre. So we have Lucina Messal and Joseph Bredo. We have Czyklinska, we have Lucina Messal in the corner there. Warsaw was hungry for operetta. Some of the performances very quickly reached hundreds of performances. And I've got later on, I'll show you some of the slides of some of the more famous famous operettas. But one of them, for instance, in 1901, Rozwódka, or Die geschiedene Frau, or The Divorced Woman, just in 1 year of 1909, it reached 120 performances with two of the most famous operetta divas of Warsaw, Victoria Kawecka and Lucina Messal, in main roles. Operetta performances in Warsaw's theatre Nowości were also known for the richness of costumes and fashionable clothes, the fashion that came directly from European cities like Paris and Vienna, for example. The latest jewellery, dresses and gowns and lingerie and shoes were ordered directly from the shops and dressmakers, contributing to not only to advertising their products, but also obviously making it easier for the theatres. by saving them space on and money on the design, space on storage, and so on. One could read about costumes in the press and about what the stars were wearing, not only on stage but also off stage, and lots of newspaper articles would comment on what Luciana Messal was wearing outside of the theatre, especially Parisian fashions were mentioned. They were discussing the colour of the hair and, you know, the shoes that they're wearing and so on. All these were brought, as I mentioned, not only in Poland, but from Paris and Vienna. Furniture for the sets of the operettas were bought in Vienna, for instance, one of the performances of Die Keuche Susanna in 1911. The sets were ordered from a furniture maker in Vienna, and the piano for one of the scenes was ordered from Berlin. When a hugely successful Linke's Venus in Warsaw, or in German, Venus auf Erden, was premiered in Warsaw in 1905, one of the critics, Rosenzweig, reflected, 6 years ago, the Apollo Theatre in Berlin announced Venus auf Erden, promoting the show so intensely that 14 days before the premiere, there were no tickets left for any price. I wanted to buy a ticket even if it was in the worst seat, succeeding only after many efforts. Now I can compare the visuals and the music. In Berlin, it was advertised that they imported Vienna artists to play Venus. I can't remember her name. And some stage sets were ordered in the finest of places. It was supposed to be the eighth wonder of the world. The promotion was very successful. The show was given 800 times with full audience. And what about us in Warsaw? Here, we didn't have a lot of advertising and relied only on our own efforts. But our stage sets were so impressive that directors from Berlin should visit us to learn from Ludwig Szywinski, the director, how operettas should be done. Although I admit that I was impressed by Berlin's version, ours was truly amazing. This production was also very famous for incredible lighting designs and effects, as many critics noticed. And I just very briefly, this is one of the sets of Die Keuche Susanna, where the furniture and everything for the stage was brought from Vienna. And that's another slide. Ludwig Szywinski is an important figure in Warsaw Operetta. He headed the Theatre Nowości for 25 years and was a hugely prolific director. He had a really large network of practitioners, not only in Poland, but also in Vienna, Berlin, and elsewhere in Europe. And he was prolific. Only in 4 years, between 1910 and 1914, he staged 78 operettas. That's roughly 20 operettas a year. I found, actually, during one of my recent trips to Warsaw, a deck of playing cards which had all the operetta stars from the Nowości theatres on them, which just demonstrates how popular these people were. This is Ludwig Szywinski as the king, and I also found a book of watercolors, which also presented these people from Nowości, so Ludwig Szywinski again appears as the king. This is Luciana Messal. And here's Joseph Redo. And Joseph Redo and Luciana Messal were also known as the two people who danced the first tango in Warsaw together.
Anastasia, we need to come to the end.
Yes, I'm actually done almost. So just to, these are some of the performers, some of the more well-known performers in the Nowości Theatre. Just to, in conclusion, I wanted to say that Warsaw was very quick to bring productions from Vienna and Berlin. In his encyclopedia on the musical theatre, Kurt Gansel often refers to Budapest as the first city to stage first foreign language productions outside of Germany. And of course, Poland or Warsaw are not mentioned at all. However, it was Warsaw in many cases that was first to bring Viennese and Berlin productions. And it was the case with quite a number of operettas. Amongst them, we have The Merry Widow, Countess Maritza, Ein Walzertraum, or The Waltz Dream, and Zigeunerliebe. Okay, I think we can finish on that. I just wanted to say that it is important to know that there were other centers of operetta in Europe, and Warsaw is perhaps the least known of them, and it is just an important place to consider, and there's much to be done in the study of the development and the development of this genre, not only in Warsaw, but of course elsewhere in Poland. Thank you.